Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
You know, as weird as this economy is, some things are looking pretty good. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Jerez in for Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, August 29th. Good to have you along. All right, we're going to start off with a macroeconomic lens, with the focus on the darling that is the American dollar. For more than a year now, the U.S. dollar has slowly gained strength compared to other major global currencies, talking about the euro, yen, the Canadian dollar. This morning in European trading, the dollar index, which is the thing that measures the greenback against other currencies, briefly hit a 20-year high before falling back a bit later in the day. The dollar is essentially at par with the euro. $1 will get you 1 euro. Mitchell Hartman reports on what's going on.
The most important force driving the dollar up against other major currencies is U.S. monetary policy.
It starts with the Fed.
Ross Mayfield at Baird says the Federal Reserve's not only been raising U.S. interest rates aggressively to wrestle down inflation, but Fed Chair Powell has pledged he won't stop till he wins.
The Fed is probably the most influential central bank in the globe, as hawkish as any right now in order to tame down domestic inflation. And so as U.S. interest rates rise, capital flows into our country, pushes up the price of the dollar.
The dollar's rise is also about what's going on in the rest of the world, says Maurice Obstfeld at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
There's a strong tendency for the dollar to strengthen whenever the global economy is in some sort of crisis. And so as markets panic, investors flee to safety, the dollar appreciates.
The dollar's persistent strength also tells us something about the U.S. economy's prospects, especially compared to Europe's, which is in the midst of war and already likely in recession, says Jay Hatfield at Infrastructure Capital Advisors.
Europe is having an energy crisis, and it's getting worse and worse almost every day. So we think the fundamentals in the U.S. are quite strong, but they're quite weak in Europe.
There are losers from the strong dollar, including U.S. exporters whose products are more expensive for foreign buyers. But if you're an American and fly across the Atlantic,
this is a great time to be spending dollars in Europe.
Sharon O'Halloran studies political economy at Columbia University, but right now she's actually on sabbatical in Dublin, where she did the latte test, buying her Morning Joe in euros.
It's 350 here, and then you do it relative to what the latte would cost in New York.
Which is $4.75 at the Starbucks down the street from our bureau in Manhattan. Wishing I was reporting this story from Ireland, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We should all just relocate there. On Wall Street today, classic case of the Mondays. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so a little more on the fundamental strengths in this economy right now. There's the strong dollar, which we just talked about, and then there's the strong job market. We've got a lot of jobs data coming out this week, including JOLTS tomorrow, which will tell us how many job openings there were in July. And then we've got this month's jobs report coming out Friday. Now, just a refresher, in July, we added 528,000 jobs, and the unemployment rate lowered to 3.5%. which is a 50-year low. We got Sarah Cheney Cambon on the line. She wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about this current state of the job market.
We have seen that job openings have been really high over the past year or so, and unemployment has come down a lot. So there are just fewer workers looking for jobs than there were a year ago. The unemployment rate's actually at, you know, a 50-year low. And so as a result, companies are still trying really hard to find workers and fill those open roles.
Yeah. And you've been talking to a lot of workers who've recently been laid off and are looking for jobs. What sorts of things have you been hearing from them?
Yes, yeah. I mean, everyone has their unique story, so it's not like unemployment is short and easy for everyone by any means. But the workers that I spoke with for this story were saying that, you know, they were laid off from all sorts of different companies, and then they were surprised at how many recruiters started reaching out to them and how fast they were able to find work, which really speaks to kind of, again, how strong that labor demand is right now.
You had a great anecdote about this guy named Reggie. Can you share his story with us?
Yes, yeah. So Reggie is from South Carolina, and he was telling me that in early August, he got on this Zoom call and found out that he was losing his job. He was in a sort of manager role as part of broader layoffs at this health insurance company he worked at. And he had been sort of in kind of talks. They were very casual with this company, an insurance company, but nothing was really concrete. And he thought that it would take, you know, about a month at least to find a new job. But then around 1 p.m. on the same day that he was laid off, a recruiter called him up from the insurance company and was like, "I've got good news. I've got a job offer for you." And this is the first time that the recruiter had ever told, you know, a worker or made a job offer the same day that someone had gotten laid off. So
that's
wild. Pretty crazy. Yeah.
How long do you think this labor market can stay this hot? I mean, are we seeing any signs of things cooling down?
We are seeing some signs of cool down. It's not nearly as fast as I think a lot of economists expected it would be. But we have seen that jobless claims, which is basically a proxy for layoffs, have ticked up some over the past few months. We've seen that job openings have declined from a record high. So it's still high, but just less high. And job growth is still strong, but it's not like it was at the very or the early stages of the pandemic when companies were reopening and kind of had to hire back.
And I feel like, you know, there's a lot of talk right now about, are we on the verge of a recession? Are we not? I feel like with a market like this, I mean, how do you respond to that question? Because it sure doesn't seem like it.
Right. It's a really interesting time because there are all of these sort of economic challenges. Like the housing market has been doing pretty poorly the past few months. The American consumer is in okay shape, but they've definitely been more cautious with their spending. And of course, everyone's dealing with really high inflation. And we saw the economy contract in the first two quarters of the year. So there are all these challenges, but at the same time, the job market is still this bright spot, really. And it's overall doing, outperforming kind of the rest of the economy, but it's also a big part of the economy. So
yeah,
we'll leave it up to the economists to decide like whether we're in a recession, but
fair enough.
It's an interesting time for sure.
Yeah. Sarah Cheney-Cambon is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much for joining us, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, a story about New York City, traffic, and some very, very strong opinions. Over the last several days, hundreds of New Yorkers have signed up to speak at public hearings about the city's controversial plan to charge drivers entering Manhattan's Central Business District. Known as congestion pricing, this strategy to reduce car traffic and all the bad stuff that comes with it is already a thing in cities like London, Singapore, and Stockholm. New York's plan could go into effect as early as next year, with tolls as high as $23 during peak hours to drive into the busy midtown and financial districts, the same areas where businesses and city leaders are desperately trying to lure back office workers. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports on how these efforts might just collide.
Matthew Turner, an economist at Brown, likes to use an analogy to explain how congestion pricing works by comparing how we treat roads to a line for free bread. Stay with me.
We have all of this stuff. We make it available to people for free. People line up to use it. It gets full, and once it's full, you have to wait for the system to clear out before you can use it.
Charging tolls to use roads, like charging the market price for bread, disincentivizes crowding.
People reschedule their trips or take them by a different mode or don't take them at all.
And it's that last part, not taking trips at all, that might be a problem.
The question of commuting to work and whether or not it makes sense to go into the office place has actually become a really big reason why people don't.
Brian Kropp leads HR research at Gartner. He says offices in New York have among the lowest return rate of workers in the country. The Business Group Partnership for New York City says only 8% of office workers are going in full time. And building security company Castle shows office occupancy in the city leveling off around 40%. Kropp says a Manhattan congestion charge probably isn't going to help.
If you're an employer, this just creates another hurdle that you have to overcome.
New Yorkers have longer than average commutes. Of course, most, when they do go in, take public transit, not cars. But remote work, ongoing health concerns, and some high-profile instances of transit violence have all taken a toll on ridership, which stands at about 60% of pre-pandemic levels.
Transit is at a crucial turning point.
Danny Perlstein with the Riders Alliance says with the revenues generated by the proposed congestion pricing, about $1 billion a year, transit service could be improved to attract riders lost during the pandemic. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
No, your home is planned because of the housing market.
Okay, well, that makes me feel better. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones gave up 184 points, almost 0.6%, to finish at 32,098. The NASDAQ fell 124 points, a little over 1%, to end at 12,017. And the S&P 500 slid 27 points, 0.2%, to land at 4030. NASA will try again Friday to get its Artemis 1 mission off the ground. The agency scrubbed the launch planned for this morning after some engine trouble. Aerojet Rocketdyne Holdings, which built the four main engines, picked up almost 0.6%. One of the contractors on the project, Boeing, added just over 0.5%. And speaking of Boeing, UPS has ordered 8 more 767 jets. Shares in United Parcel Service dipped 0.8%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.11%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. When the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June, abortion access became limited or illegal in several states. including at least 17 where the procedure is now severely restricted or banned. One of those states is Tennessee. An abortion ban went into effect last Thursday, and it doesn't criminalize those who have a pregnancy terminated. It punishes those who perform the abortions. Blake Farmer of WPLN in Nashville reports.
Dr. Carolyn Thompson entered obstetrics and gynecology more than 30 years ago when she had no thought of Roe v. Wade being overturned.
I had no idea that I would be setting myself up to be a criminal. And that's pretty much the way it is now.
Because abortions happen all the time to care for a miscarriage or other non-viable pregnancies, that's one reason the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists has made an unequivocal statement that abortion is an essential component of comprehensive, evidence-based health care. But Tennessee's law has no real exceptions for doctors. If charged, it's on them to prove that their actions were justified to save the life of a mother. Thompson says she's treading lightly.
I mean, I've already had circumstances where I have to leave the room and say, hey, I've got to call my liability carrier because I need to find out what's acceptable for me to tell you.
She even worried how far she could go instructing the patient where to get a procedure in another state. Thompson is seeking counsel, even though she's often the one giving advice as a medical litigation consultant. In Chattanooga, Dr. Layla Zahedi says she has an attorney on speed dial.
That is why I have a criminal defense lawyer on retainer, so that I have someone to say, like, is this legal? Is it safe?
That retainer costs her $10,000. She's a high-risk obstetrician, so all of her patients have complications. Often they have a desired pregnancy, but caring for a mother with health problems can be a delicate balance with the life of the fetus. And Zahedi says doctors are no longer making decisions based on medical training and what's best for the patient.
They're making decisions to protect themselves, which is the right thing to do in most cases, right? Like, I can do no one any good if I don't have a license or if I'm in jail, quite honestly. I am no good to anyone at that point.
But Chicago attorney and anti-abortion activist Paul Linton says doctors acting in good faith have nothing to fear. He helped write the new law in Tennessee and several other states.
If there are unusual circumstances that justify an abortion, there's no doubt in my mind that a prosecutor would not charge someone.
At least not a responsible prosecutor, he adds. But OBGYNs say there's not enough appreciation of the nuance they face every day. Take the patient Dr. Zahedi just treated, 15 weeks along, and her water had broken, but the fetus still had a heartbeat. Infection risk for the mother increases by the day. But Zahedi says she's probably sending that mother out of state now. Many OBGYNs are playing it safe, including Dr. Kimberly Looney.
I don't see a lot of my colleagues falling on the sword. I don't think that'll happen.
Up until a few weeks ago, Looney was performing abortions all the time as chief medical officer for Planned Parenthood of Tennessee and North Mississippi. She's now left that job to go into private practice, and she says she may face extra scrutiny because of her resume.
I've always felt like a target. It was just the fact that me knowing that I believe in a woman's right to choose and me making the choice to be her advocate will always make me a target.
Looney says, however, the rest of the medical profession is about to get a dose of reality because she's the one who took the difficult patient in the past when a sticky situation came up. When abortions were still allowed on a limited basis, she would hear from a cancer doctor about a pregnant patient who needed to terminate in order to receive aggressive treatment, or about a rape victim or a pregnant child, now with no exceptions.
For that pediatrician with a 12-year-old that's pregnant, because it happens, that's now your problem. It's an everybody problem.
Looney says doctors of all kinds, not just OBGYNs, will end up facing the consequences in states implementing all-out bans. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
If you've been house or apartment hunting lately, you know that it's rough out there. Home prices are starting to soften a bit, and we'll get a better sense of that tomorrow by way of the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. But what I want to talk about right now are the things inside those homes, the design flourishes that you see over and over and over again. And for those of you hunting for a new place, you've definitely seen them. I'm talking about the laminate gray floors, the subway tiled backsplashes, the kitchen cabinets with minimalist open shelving, the barn door that glides, the mosaic glass tiled shower stalls. I'm going to stop now before I sound even more like a realtor. But you get the picture. Amanda Mole, a staff writer at The Atlantic, wrote about all of this. Amanda, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I feel a little called out by your article. I've got those great floors. I've got a subway tiled backsplash. I've got the most generic looking apartment, which I guess is kind of the point of your article, right?
Right, right. You know, I have consumed so many hours and hours and hours of HGTV over the years. And just over time, like the gray floors started to, like, I think, eat away at like a part of my brain. It's been clear to me that for a long time that there's something about this, and I feel like I finally developed a theory of it.
Okay, so let's talk about the theory. Why do so many homes look the same? Why do they look like this?
Well, the reasons that these sort of design tropes occur over and over and over again in homes is really sort of a function of how housing in America is financialized. Mm-hmm. Especially in the past 5 years, more and more homes have been bought up either by people who are looking to flip them, which is buy them, fix them up, usually sort of cosmetically, and then get them out and sold again within a year, or people who are looking for more traditional types of investment properties, landlords, institutional investors, things like that. And the best way to increase housing value is to sort of take care of these cosmetic things that renters or buyers are sort of looking at as indicators of housing quality. And you can do that pretty inexpensively through some of these design tropes. The gray flooring is usually vinyl plank, which costs about $1 per square foot, which is a fraction of what like real hardwood costs. Mm. You know, mosaic tile in the shower stalls is very easy to install. It comes in sheets. And yeah. America's housing stock is aging. So a lot of these sort of like quick fix surface things are a sort of communication between sellers or leasing companies and buyers that like what you're getting is updated and fancy.
Interesting. And do you have a sense of how far back this goes? And does it have anything to do with HGTV?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the gray floors themselves seem to go about 10 years, particularly after the Great Recession, when there was so much distressed housing, and foreclosures and short sales are great for house flippers because they really give you like a rock bottom price. So during that period after the Great Recession, the early 2010s, you saw a lot of HGTV shows about house flipping, about investment properties. And you've got an enormously popular cable network. It's the most popular cable network after the three big cable news channels.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's bigger than ESPN, and it has been durably for several years. So you've got basically this how-to manual playing 24 hours a day to millions of people. And the end of these shows, they break down like what was paid for the house, what was paid for the updates and the labor, and like, you know, if it sells at that price, how much profit you're going to make. Mm-hmm. And those numbers and these types of entertainment is just really, really attractive to people.
I know. I watch those things and I'm like, Can I flip a home? Should I?
They're massively entertaining. They really have a great formula going. Even though, like, I am obviously critical of this dynamic and what it does to housing in America and people's homes, but like, it's fun to watch people do that.
Yeah. Can you share a little bit more in terms of numbers? You had some really, I think, surprising numbers in that article that get at what we're talking about.
What was most surprising to me is that in the first quarter of this year, what we saw nationwide is that almost 10% of home sales were flips. Wow. And then another quarter of home sales were bought by investors. So
quarter.
Yes, a full quarter. Landlords, Airbnb, tycoon wannabes. So what you get from that is about a third of all homes sold in the United States in the first, you know, 3 months of this year were sold to people who have no intention of living in them.
Wow. And so have we seen any real pushback to this aesthetic or any sign that things might start going in a different direction?
Well, I do think that anecdotally, you see some people who are just sick of the gray floors in particular, mm-hmm. because at first gray seems like a great neutral. It seems like, okay, I can move into this place, not worry about it. My furniture will go with this, my decor, whatever, it will be fine. And then you get in there and it doesn't really work like that.
No.
Because all of these gray floors are just really cool toned. And a lot of things that make a space feel like warm and inviting and lived in and homey are warm toned.
So basically my home is bland, not because of my doing.
No, your home is bland because of the housing market.
Amanda Moll is a staff writer at The Atlantic who wrote about all of this. You should check out her work. Amanda, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out. At the top of the show, we talked about this tight labor market we're in. Axios surfaced a bus survey today from Hop Skip Drive, a school ride service company, and it showed that 88% of schools, let me say that number again in case you missed it, 88% are dealing with bus driver shortages. So in Michigan, for example, they need more than 450 bus drivers. In North Carolina, my home state, the largest school district there is slashing more than 50 of its bus routes. And in Chicago, some students are facing travel times as long as 90 minutes. The reasons for this shortage are nothing new. Schools have long struggled to recruit new drivers. Some have tried bumping up the pay, which has helped in some cases, but clearly hasn't solved the problem. All right, we're about to go, but first, here's your moment of economic context. In Mitchell's piece earlier about the strong dollar, he mentioned the so-called latte test, and how basically a latte is cheaper in Europe right now than it is here. And that most definitely includes Starbucks pumpkin spice latte. From CNN today, the grande size will now be $5.95 instead of $5.45. Of course, depends on where you live, but let me tell you, that is money I personally will not be spending. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Giong, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. And I'm Rima Jerez. All right, we'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.